Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradox class on Christmas Eve. What a very cool thing. Merry Christmas, everybody. And if you can look up for a moment from stuffing your face and talking to your friends, we have a couple of announcements. So welcome, everybody. Greetings. This is really great to see this many people. Hugh, maybe we should do a potluck every Sunday and we'll get, you know, 40 or 50 people here. Well, we're going to have Dr. Ross with us today, but he's not going to be doing the teaching, which is kind of interesting. So keep getting the food. We're going to have kind of a festive time this morning. There's a couple of announcements. Our friend Ted Bates back here has written a little booklet that's in those Merry Christmas envelopes over there, so you might want to grab one. You probably don't know what it is. It's called The Tree of Forgiveness, so take a look at that. Dr. Ross is going to be with us every Sunday through, I think the first one where he's going to be away is January 14th and 21st. So, Hugh, are you going to continue your series on habitable zones for a while? Good. It's a really interesting discussion. Well, what I usually do is introduce Dr. Ross, and he comes up and speaks. But this time, I'm going to introduce Dr. Ross, and he's going to come up and introduce the speaker. So would you all please give a hand for Dr. Ross? And Hugh, while you're up here, would you mind saying a blessing for the meal?
Yes. Yeah, Father in heaven, we do thank you for this opportunity to gather together and fellowship over this food that you've so generously provided. And we also thank you for the opportunity to live in the 21st century. We have this amazing technology where we can extend fellowship with people all over the world. So, Lord, I pray that you would really anoint Dave as he gives this message to us today and bless us as we fellowship around these tables. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, it's my privilege to introduce Dave Sargent, and I've heard a version of your talk before, Dave, and I'm really excited to see what developments you have. In fact, the slideshow is amazing that he's given us about birds. But I just wanted to share with all of you that birds have had a big impact on my life, including coming to faith in Jesus Christ. Because when I was a teenager, I had a pet parrot. And it's that relationship with that pet parrot that taught me a significant spiritual lesson. And you know, Dave is going to be speaking about these spiritual lessons. I actually wrote about them in my book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. And, you know, Dave, I think you agree with me. Birds are different than the mammals that we typically have as pets. They're highly social, and they teach us significant social lessons. That's probably the one thing I learned from my parrot. Never leave it alone. It just loves having people around. And, we need to have that kind of relationship basis as well. So I'm going to turn over to you.
Okay. That mic goes back in the back. Take it with you.
Oh, take it with me. Okay, you're already set up. Thank you.
All right, so I brought today one of my two rock doves, and you probably call them pigeons, and in the city, and when they look like this, we usually call them pigeons. The more scientific name for them is a rock dove. A pigeon is a type of dove, and this is Myrtle. And we're going to bring her out a little bit more later and talk about more, but she fell out of a nest at a very high altitude, and we're not able to get the bird back in the nest, and even if I did, it would have fallen out again because the mom had built it on a ledge that was too thin. So my daughter and I hand-raised this, just like an infant baby. We had to feed it every 15 minutes, and then pretty soon you lengthen out the feeding time, and after about maybe a month and a half, 2 months, it could sleep through the night like a baby, so at least they grow up faster. In the wild, she would only live maybe 3 to 7 years, but in captivity, she'll live 20 years. And I've had pigeons with me that have died of old age of 20 years. So we're gonna learn about birds. We're gonna bring her back out later.
What's her name?
That's Myrtle. My daughter found her in Monrovia, the Monrovia Community Pool, and so she named it after the main road in Monrovia, Myrtle. So I have had birds as pets. Oop, can we bring my slideshow up? I've had birds as pets for 60 years, and for 60 years I've been taking care of birds. Every single bird that I've ever had has a different personality, just like what Hugh has talked about. One of the unique things about birds is once they are bonded to you, or they're tame and bonded to you, as Hugh talked about, they have very unique personalities. This bird that I have here was the one that I had for 20 years. It was a white dove named Squeaky. And out of all my birds that I've had, this one was the one that was most bonded to me. And because it was the most bonded to me, it was the one that wanted to please me the most. And so Squeaky would do anything that I trained it to do, including sit on my cat. But of course, I first had to train my cat not to eat the bird. And so Squeaky, as you could see, would come in the house and had no problem sitting on the cat, because the cat also was bonded to me. And so the cat was taught, don't eat the bird. And the bird was caught that the cat's part of the family member. So one of the amazing things about birds is they're very sensitive to pick up our emotions. Just as animals, our cats also can pick up on our emotions when we're sad. Birds also, I think, can pick up just as well our emotions. So Hugh's already quoted this verse in Job, where the Bible tells us to study the birds because they will teach us. And one of the problems we have in the cities, we're cut off from these things that God has given to teach us. So take a look at birds. We find birds in Genesis in the very beginning, and we have here both a command and a prediction that God says that birds are going to increase on the earth, implying that birds are going to fill the earth. And so we're going to take a look and see if that prediction is correct. This was written thousands of years by somebody that definitely hadn't traveled around the world to see if birds were around the world. And so we know this is one of the ways that Scripture is inspired, because you can look at things like this, where someone thousands of years ago in the Middle East claimed that birds are going to fill the earth. Hugh has written about this and spoken on this, and so have I. The biblical view of life, and so the Bible is not a science book, but when it talks about science, it gets everything right, and that's part of Hugh's ministry. And the Bible classifies life in three different ways. We have physical life, which is lower life forms, fish, reptiles, amphibians. We have soulish life, or the Hebrew word nephesh, which applies to birds and mammals. These are animals that I just talked about that have wills, emotions, personalities. And then lastly, his last creation was mankind. And what the Bible describes that is not toolmakers like science has, but spiritual beings. It's quite interesting when we go and find civilizations in jungles that have been cut off from other human civilization for years, they'll always have some form of worship, some type of prayer. And that's because we are made in God's image and we are spirit beings, and that's the Bible's definition of life. So when we say soulish life, what do we mean? So I already mentioned a will and personality. I have two pigeons, and they definitely have different personalities and different ones more strong-willed than the other one. Personalities, emotions, you can tell when they're happy, when they're sad. Bonding, they bond to one another, and then they will also bond to humans. I've had people see my doves and say, oh gosh, that's so cool, I would like one of them, and they would go out and buy two doves, and they would come to me and say, Dave, I have two doves, and they're not like your doves at all. I'm like, well, how many did you buy? Two. And I'm like, well, if you buy two doves, you have two doves. If you have one dove, then you have a pet, right? So this bird is bonded to me so much that she will not tolerate any other birds to be in her presence. If I bring the other bird out and she sees it, she gets very jealous and she'll get mad at me for a couple days. So again, the bonding part is exclusive. Nurturing, so birds and mammals will nurture their young, and a desire to please and serve others, including humans, when they bond to you. Creation is not just in Genesis. In Psalm 104 is one of the major creation psalms. And in that psalm, it talks about that it's the nature of life to go extinct, but that God renews the face of the earth, in other words, replaces life that has died out. And we definitely see that in the fossil record. And we're going to talk about that a little bit. There's another verse in the creation, Psalm 104. The first time that I read this, I was like, well, of course, the oceans are filled with living things. There's lots of fish. And then I read it again, and it's like, well, no, that actually would apply to whales and seals and dolphins also. And the next time I read it, it's like, no, wait a second, that applies to every life. We have reptiles in the ocean, which is sea turtles and sea snakes. Sea snakes are very poisonous, stay away from them. But it also applies at any moment in time, right, like right now, there are thousands of birds under the water. We have penguins that fish. I have puffins here, the northern Atlantic penguin that's extinct. There's lots of seabirds that spend a lot of time under the water fishing. And so, again, the writer of this psalm, not being a scientist, got it correct that the ocean is teeming with life and all types of life. So birds are unique. Out of all of the animals, the most unique feature is feathers. If it has feathers, it's a bird. If it doesn't have feathers, it's not a bird. One of the things I learned very quickly, just even as a child, is we were taught in school that there's cold-blooded animals and warm-blooded animals. And when I had my birds, I went back to my teachers and said, well, no, birds are actually very warm-blooded. When my bird just sits on my hand, I feel his warm feet. If my bird flies around and comes back and lands on my feet, he's even warmer. So, you know, I would say that this 115 degree could be even higher than that if a bird's flying on a hot summer day. Temperatures that would kill humans, who kill mammals, are perfectly normal for birds. I mean, if you think about it, if you were out running in a down jacket, what would your body temperature, you know, go up to? And yet that's normal for birds. Birds are completely designed for flight in that they're very lightweight. Their bones are filled with air. And they have unidirectional lungs that operate at 100% efficiency. To fly, you need lots of energy. And so they have 100% efficient lungs. We're going to look at that a little bit more closer. Birds have a crop in their neck. Typical bird behavior is to go out and feed in the morning. They'll fill their stomach and also fill their crop in their neck. And in the afternoon, they'll flock and socialize together and then use the food in their crop and their neck out. That's except for owls. Just as we have marsupials are very different type of mammals, owls and penguins are very different types of birds. In the sense that they don't have a crop in their neck. Owls are specially designed to be the stealth night fighters in the bird world. Birds have a very high metabolism. This is very difficult for having them as a pet, because you really can't tell when they're sick. My birds would always just go, 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 and then they would just die. And so it's very difficult because they have a super high metabolism. Most amazing thing about birds is about 90% of them pair for life. At the death of a spouse, some of them will continue grieving the rest of their life, and some of them will remate. Then we had that prediction that God's going to fill the earth with birds, and the birds are the only animal that are found on all continents and all oceans. No other species fills that. And particularly, I have penguins there because they're the only animal that lives in Antarctica, especially designed to live in minus 70 degree temperature. Freezing design. And then for the continents, what we have is the albatross. We're going to look at the albatross a little bit more closely, and they cover all the oceans of the world. Birds have excellent eyesight. You know, we have that phrase, eyes as sharp as an eagle. That's not just a saying. Eagles actually have the sharpest eye. They can spot a mouse 2 miles away. Very, very sharp vision. Birds can see ultraviolet. So when you see these pigeons with this iridescent on their neck, it looks astounding to us, but to a bird, it's like a neon light because birds can actually see ultraviolet vision. It also helps birds like a hummingbird look for flowers. All birds have excellent vocalization. They have songs or calls. And of course, to hear those wonderful songs and calls, they have excellent hearing. They have very large brain sizes for their body size, so their intelligence is quite high. They have four toes, and on each four toes will be a claw. And then all birds go through various types of courtship. Courtship usually involves some type of dance, could include songs, bringing your other mate food, the case of birds of prey. You can see some magnificent footage of birds of prey doing acrobatic dances in the air. Nest building. Some birds are excellent weavers. Tail thumping, preening, which is taking their beak to clean feathers, and even gift giving. There's even one bird that actually sets up a stage, decorates the stage, and dances on it. We already talked about this. All birds will go through mourning when their mate is gone, and some of them will remate, and some of them will not. So this is, when you think about this verse in Job, this is also one that scientists have learned just recently. Ecology is an environmental quality, is a big issue nowadays. And we used to send out scientists and go out and count all the plants and all the insects, all the animals in a particular ecosystem and do that every year to see if the ecosystem is degrading or it's maintaining its quality. We found out that if you actually just count the birds at a particular time of year, come back the next year, count the same amount of birds, and if you have the same amount of birds or more, you know the quality of the ecosystem is the same because the birds are reliant on the ecosystem. If you lose all your birds that are eating seeds, maybe there's something wrong with your plants. If you're losing birds that eat insects, there's probably something going on with the insect population. Or birds that fish, if there's water there, or the cleanup crew, as I call them, condors and vultures. So we've learned that we can just really look at the birds to see the quality of the ecosystem. It's very varied. I've heard anywhere from 10,000 to 18,000 bird species are alive today, and they fill all the niches and ecosystems of the planet. Desire to please. So we talked about how birds are designed to please humans, and some birds are much more designed to want to be with humans and to be next to humans, and some of them, like ravens, raven crows are very similar, but yet they're completely different. Crows love people. You see them all through our city. You will not find any ravens here in Los Angeles. The ravens stay out in the desert and the mountains because they don't like people. These two animals really loved people, and it cost them their life. We knew that the passenger pigeon population was getting low, and our human sim nature, we killed them all off, and the last one died in a zoo in the 1914. There used to be a penguin in the north. A lot of people say, well, there's only penguins at the south. It's like, no, there was a penguin in the north, but not related to a penguin. Again, we knew the population was getting low. Some islands were set aside. There were signs telling people not to go there. People went there anyways and killed them all off, which is a great loss to lose this penguin of the north. We talked about birds have excellent vocalization, and to go with that, birds have excellent hearing. So their ears are very similar to mammal ears. So they can hear very high frequencies, very low frequencies, and have ears very similar to humans. And of course, that's also important for their stabilization in flight. Hughes talked about this, talking birds. So a number of birds have both the hardware to speak and the brain, the intelligence, the very large brains to body match to speak. I won't have time to show it here, but if you want to see a really intelligent bird, a zoo has a bird named Einstein that they've trained, and it has over 1,000 words. And because it's so bonded to its trainer, it can actually answer questions. So it looks like the bird's answering the actual question, but really the bird is so trained to bond to the trainer that when the trainer does whatever, the bird responds. Part of that, these birds also are very attuned to emotions. So they can pick up just the slightest human subtle body languages and respond appropriately. Some birds that speak are also mimickers. I had a friend who had a bird outside of its house that could imitate its phone and its alarm system, and just drove him crazy, right? Because, you know, he's always picking up his phone, and this bird was just absolute perfect, you know, on the telephone and his alarm system. It just drove him absolutely crazy. We talked about feathers. Feathers are what makes birds birds. Feathers are so complex that honest scientists will tell you that they do not completely understand feathers. So the feathers are grown inside of a white tube that you see here, and they have blood veins to them, And once the feather is fully grown, fully matured with its all of its intricate structure and colorization, the color can be different, usually different on the top and the bottom for camouflage or for just decoration, so that makes it complex. The structure of itself is very complex. Once it's fully developed, the blood vessel is cut off to that feather. The white casing flakes away, kind of like dandruff. When I was just holding my bird recently, I looked at my hands, and they're all covered in that white dandruff. Most birds will molt or lose their feathers once a year. A few birds will do it twice a year for camouflage. So there's some grouses that will be white in the winter and brown in the summer, so they have to molt two times a year. But most birds will molt once a year. That's mostly because the feathers will get damaged, they'll get dirty, and they'll need to be replaced. I have a little baby pigeon here, and when it was first born, it was covered with this yellow down feather, like on its head. And this one here, the yellow down feather is going away, and his new flight feathers are coming in. And so this is what Myrtle looked like when I found her, was about like that picture there. I'm not going to talk about this one in detail, just to say that feathers are very complex. Almost every feather on a bird is different. So the wing feathers, as you can see, are contoured longer at the end and get shorter. We call those wing feathers, but the longest ones are called primary feathers. Then they have the secondary feathers, and then the leading edge would be like the flap on an airplane, right? And then you have some microscopic views to see the intricate detail in the feathers. So feathers are very, very complex. The main feathers are the down feathers that are fur that keep the animal warm, and the other feathers all have different names but are on the wings for flight. Or in the case of penguins, underwater flight, right? So we have some flightless birds also, but they have feathers also. So feathers are very, very complex, which is why, like I said, the scientists do not completely understand them. Myrtle here has about 10,000 feathers on her. A small songbird will have about 2,000 feathers, and then the emperor penguin, to keep it warm, has 80,000 feathers. So it can go all the way from 2 to 80,000. Comparable, I looked it up, that if my bird Myrtle here was a mammal, it would have about 3 million hairs on it. So even though it's a big number, if you had hair, the follicles are closer together and more dense. We talked about birds in order to fly, or in the case of an ostrich, to run, get away from its predator. They have 100% efficient lungs. So this means they breathe into a clean air sac, and they have valves in their airway to make sure that happens. The air is squeezed through a whole bunch of tubes, and then the air goes into a stale air sac, and then they breathe out of that. As opposed to most animals like us, we have 50% efficient lungs, which is basically lots of little balloons that inflate and deflate that only operate at 50%. And if we look at a microscope, the structure of the lungs themselves are very complex. And give it 100% efficiency. I say that because there are other animals that have unidirectional lungs. So the crocodile family, the green iguana, and the monitor lizard have unidirectional lungs, but they don't operate at 100% efficiency. They don't have an exhale sac. They don't have valves to make sure the air doesn't go backwards. And then if you were to put their lungs under a microscope and compare it to bird lungs, the lungs are just not as complex and don't operate at 100% efficiency. We have questions at the end. Crocodiles also have special four-chambered hearts. It's not like a bird heart. It's not like a mammal heart. It actually has an extra valve that is able to direct extra blood to the digestive system. So it's only recently that we wondered why. Why would these animals need to have extra, blood flow? And of course, that's for digestion. And if you think about what crocodiles and monitor lizards eat, they'll eat like, the whole leg of a deer. It takes a lot of energy to digest that. And so they don't use that to increase their metabolism, but they use it to digest. Unique to doves. Come on out, Myrtle. Yeah, I know you want to come out. We were talking about you. You're going to get all excited. Oops. Went backwards here. Unique to doves. So we talked about owls are very unique in the bird family. Penguins are very unique in the family. We talked about this is we would see on the cities, we would call this a pigeon The technical name for it, again, is a rock dove. So these are things unique to doves that other birds don't have. The first one is they have a gland in their neck that produces a gray milk. We call it pigeon milk or dove milk that they feed to their young. And so they have a much higher success rate because they don't have to find seeds for their bird, for their babies. And the bird would have a difficult time digesting those seeds anyways. They are excellent navigators. She has gotten loose about 3 times, and 24 hours later, she'll always come back home because that's the way she's designed. Excellent navigators. We'll talk a little bit more about that. Found all over the world, but typically where people are, so people have transported them all around the world. They've been a symbol of peace for many years, make a distinct cooing sound. They've been used in army communications, army warfare, used for mail service, and we know that they're one of the first birds to be domesticated, both from archaeological evidence and from artwork. And of course, that was easy to do because they like to please us. They like to be around us. They like to please us. They're excellent flyers. They have a peak top speed of 90 miles per hour, putting them up in the top 10% of fastest bird. Their typical cruising speed, if you will, if you want to put in airplanes, is 50 to 60 miles an hour. Because we've domesticated them for so long, because they have this strong desire to please us, we've actually now have bred and trained them to be rollers. And this is a competition. So there's ones that will roll on the ground, where you put them on the ground, and the owner will tilt the tail up, and the bird will just roll across the stage, and they're trained to do that. Then they also have ones where they have competitions where you let them go, you know, in a park, and they fly around, and the owner gives a signal, and the bird will do somersaults in the air. And so those are competitions. Talking about excellent navigators, I was telling somebody that one of the records is somebody here in Los Angeles took a pigeon, a racing pigeon, 1,300 miles away. It flew 60 miles an hour directly home and beat them going in the car because they flew line of sight and the freeways don't go line of sight. Can fly in the dark. So this is totally amazing, obviously, that you can find a overcast night where you from horizon to horizon you have clouds, so there's not a single star, not the moon in the sky, no star. Let them go and they'll fly in the dead of night and fly straight home. And they're the only animal that can do that. And what we found is they actually are able to sense the magnetic field, which is why they're able to get home. So they have a very, very strong desire to get home, and they have the only animal that has the hardware to do it. The interesting thing is we've been using that gift that these birds have for thousands of years. The Greeks would tie the winner of the marathon race onto their bird's leg, let it go, and it'd fly back to its hometown. So that day, everybody knew who ran the marathon race. I say that these were designed for humans because just like horses and dogs are designed for to please humans in a way that they would not use in the wild, is they are not migratory birds, and they rarely travel 1 to 9 miles, 10 miles away from their home to look for food. So it's a gift that they have that we use, but they don't use it at all. 32 birds have been given medals from the U.S. government for saving soldiers' lives, again, being used for mail carriers. And the most expensive bird was a racing pigeon that sold in 2020 for almost $2 million. So we talked about that they could fly 60 miles an hour straight line. This bird could fly 70 miles an hour in a straight line and would beat all the other birds. Bibles are prevalent throughout the Bible. We have in Genesis where Noah sent out a dove. Could have been one that looked just like this, and it brought back the olive branch. That is a normal behavior. That wasn't supernatural. Birds love to take baths, given the opportunity. If you have a bucket of water, they will take a bath every day to stay clean. And so if this bird was in the ark for a long time and got loose, the first thing you'd want to do is take a bath. But these are not water birds. We can't just land in the water and take a bath, take off. As feathers get wet, this bird can't fly. It'll be too heavy, right, because it's not a water bird. So it would have looked for a floating branch to take a bath on, which was probably an olive branch. And to pick up the branch and bring it back to the ark is not unusual at all. Myrtle here loves to carry around her own feathers. When her feathers fall out, she'll carry them around. So it's just normal behavior for a bird, but it became the symbol of peace. We have in Leviticus and Numbers, doves are sown as being clean animals and acceptable for sacrifice. And in the New Testament, we see that a dove is the symbol of the Holy Spirit. That's your last slide, Myrtles. Yes, that's your last slide. You can go back in. So look at a few unique birds. I just picked them at random. Could have been owls or penguins are very special. But the smallest bird is the bee hummingbird. It's the size of a coffee bean. Very, very small, found in Cuba. And these birds have such a high metabolism, they have to feed about every 15 minutes, every 20 minutes, every half hour. And of course, they can't do that at night. They don't fly at night. And so every single night, they go into a hibernation mode where their body temperature drops, their heart rate drops, their breathing drops. And in the morning, when it warms up, when the sun's back out, it comes out of hibernation and goes out and feeds. So that's the smallest bird. Hovering and flying backwards has appeared in several species. Hummingbirds are the only ones that can do that, but we have insects that are capable of doing that also. Fastest bird is the peregrine falcon. They can dive at 240 miles per hour, and the reason they do that is their favorite food is doves and pigeons. But since she can fly 90 miles an hour and he can only fly at 68 miles per hour, how do you think it catches up to a dove? Is it gets above? And I've actually seen this, and the doves that are smart survive. So the pigeon will be flying along, the peregrine falcon will get up above. They'll fold their wings and dive like a rock. And when we bring her out again, you'll see she has two eyes on her side of her head, and she only has a 10% blind spot on the back of her head. And if the pigeon doesn't see the hawk and doesn't react, it's gone, obviously. It gets hit and just knocked unconscious. I have actually seen it where some smart doves will be flying along, and they wait. And just as the peregrine falcon gets near, they'll fold their wings together, drop like a rock. And, of course, the peregrine falcon's going so fast, by the time it scoops up and back around, the pigeon will be hiding in bushes and trees, and the falcon will be trying to get to it and not able to. The fastest straight-out flyer is the white-throated needletail, though. It could outrun a pigeon, but it's not a bird of prey. Largest living bird is the ostrich. I have an ostrich egg here. I'm going to have it on the back table that you'll be able to look at. Hughes taught about how this was also the first original water bottle in Africa. So this one I drilled out the hole, and we had omelets for the family, then I made a whole bunch of custard for it. The ostrich is also the bird that kills the most amount of people. So I actually was talking to somebody who raised these and was giving them out and breeding them, and somebody got one and was not careful, and they can kick and have a very sharp claw in the forest and kill them. So it's also the most deadly bird in the world also. It's amazing. They can lay 40 of these eggs per year. 1,000 years ago, in the South Pacific Islands, there was the elephant bird, which was larger and heavier than an ostrich. But again, that was driven to extinction by people 1,000 years ago. 40% of all birds migrate. Unlike the pigeons, they learn migration from their parents. Their parents have to teach them the migration route. It's not built into their brain. So it's something that it's passed down from generation to generation. And that's typically to get to better feeding grounds, right? So in the north, there's lots of insects in the summer in the north, and they fly south in the wintertime to head to lower ones. And then I have the two records here is the Arctic tern is the most miles per year. And then it's amazing, obviously, that this bar-tailed bird here can fly nonstop, almost like a jet airplane in one sitting. They store so much fat that their organs actually shrink. They shrink their organs to store extra fat to be able to fly 3,000, 7,000 miles nonstop. Pretty amazing. Hughes talked a bunch about this. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this one. We know the smartest bird, and now most scientists agree, not all, also the smartest animal in the world is the crow. The New Caledonian crows are able to make hooks. When they first found these hooks laying around the island, they thought that somebody human was making them and fishing with them or whatever, and then they finally discovered that, no, it was the birds making these hooks to be able to get insects out of tight spots. They're able to solve multi-step problems. You could Google that and look at all these different puzzles that they do. And so they have problem solvers, and that's because they have excellent and very fast reasoning skills. How fast they solve these puzzles is just the amazing thing. You know, they're doing faster than I can figure out what he's doing. They can count to five. They teach their youngs, which is why these skills get passed down generation to generation. Not just skills. They've actually done experiments where they put on president's mask, and half the presidents treat the crows nice and half will treat them really terrible. They came back the next generation, and the young knew who the good guys and the bad guys were because they learned it from their parents. So we know that the parents teach on. They're in the same family as ravens and magpies and jays, which are also very smart birds. Largest wingspan, so the albatross is the one that occupies all the oceans, and that's because they'll spend 2 years at sea fishing, and they only come back to land every 2 years to mate and to make one new young. And so they beat the other birds, that they will typically fly 75,000 miles per year. Largest land bird is the condor. It's a scavenger, basically like a vulture. Wingspan of a little over 11 feet. It also has the distinction of having the best smell. It could smell, you know, a dying deer, you know, miles away. It also has the distinction of having the strongest stomach acid, things that would be revolting to us. They could eat, including a carcass full of anthrax. Their stomach acids are so strong. So they're the cleanup crew. If we didn't have condors and vultures, the wilderness would smell a lot worse. You know, so we have to be thankful for them. They're the super cleanup crew. The first bird. It's quite interesting to see the debate between scientists. Most people will cite this 160 million years ago because we have a complete fossil from that time period. I agree with the second set of scientists that say it's 210 million years ago because we have fossil footprints of a modern bird. Like that print up there, in fossils 210 million years ago. It's a long track, you know, a good 10 feet of track of this bird step. It's not just one or two steps. And just a foot from that is a full track, 100 feet track of dinosaur footprints. And this footprint is unique. No other animal has a footprint like that. Birds have very long, thin footprints or foots. And that's because obviously they use that for perching. So this was a perching bird that was there 210 million years ago walking along a mud flat. The tendons are very strong to perch. Kind of like horses, they can actually also, most birds can lock their tendons so that they can sleep at night without being falling off while they're asleep. Gust of wind can come by, they're going to stay on their perch and continue sleeping. So it's a very unique footprint that you can see it, you know, beaches or in the snow or mud places. So I would agree with the 210 million years ago presence of birds. For comparison, we have dinosaurs at 252 million years ago. The first mammal looked like a small shrew at about 205 million years ago. The first land animal, maybe about 400 million years ago. We know that these early birds were just as complex as modern birds because we have three or four amber samples where we have feathers trapped in them, and we can see that the feathers are just as complex as modern-day feathers. So there are different types of feathers. We've already talked about that, but the feathers are very complex. Scientists will tell you that birds survived the major extinction event 66 million years ago that wiped out the dinosaurs. And I say, did they? Because the birds that are before that event are completely different than the birds after the event. And we're going to look at that a little bit more in detail. So in 1986, a scientist got together and got enough scientists together and said, we're going to declare and classify birds as dinosaurs now. There are other scientists, not creationists, but other scientists saying, whoa, you know, we need more data before you make a major change like that. And their voices were not heard, and so they got together and started the band movement. Birds are not dinosaurs. And so they had just basically two messages. One, we shouldn't be calling birds dinosaurs. And two, stop putting feathers on dinosaurs because there's no evidence that dinosaurs had feathers. So it's, you know, you'll see, it's incredible. You see books now with T-Rexes, you know, with feathers, you know, and they've just been sticking on feathers on just about anything. And because once you have a desire to call birds dinosaurs and say dinosaurs had feathers, then you start looking for places that it really is not there. Yeah, we'll talk about that more. So the first thing, obviously, is that some dinosaurs had beaks, and some early birds have beaks. So the first thing I talked about this, but beaks actually appear independently in some birds, not all birds, and some dinosaurs, turtles, squids, platypus, and octopuses. And so beaks really typically haven't been used for classifying because they just show up in lots of different unrelated species. So we just don't use teeth as that. So one of the early birds had teeth. So I would go back on why we're talking about this. And so again, both in the mammal species, we have a beak like in a platypus and teeth. In the reptile area, we also have teeth and beaks. And in the bird area, it shouldn't be surprised that in birds, we have birds with teeth and birds with beaks. The early birds, ancient birds, had claws on their wings, and we have two living species of birds that have claws on their wings also, one in South America and one in Africa. Because these are the only two birds with these claws on their wings, scientists thought that maybe they should be related. And one of the wonderful things now is scientists typically were just looking at animals to see if they look similar, but now we have DNA testing that we can do. So they sequence the DNA of these two birds and discover that they're not related at all. So there's a big debate in the scientific community now, was their ancestors so far back in the past is why the DNA doesn't match, or did claws evolve independently in these two birds? It appears that all birds have an inactive genes for teeth. So we have mutations in chickens that will produce teeth, and this is a photograph of them. It's quite interesting. They don't look like the dinosaur teeth, though. They kind of look like cat molars, which is quite interesting. And so after the extinction event 66 million years ago, teeth disappear from birds. This was one of the first reasons that they called birds dinosaurs, but I noticed that in the older literature it would be there. As I read more modern literature, this has been disappearing, and that's because, you can take a look at these two pictures and just answer your question yourself. So originally it was thought that the pelvic bone in dinosaurs and lizards pointed forward, and then in birds it seemed to point backwards. But I looked at a lot of these pictures, a lot of photographs of fossils, and it's really hard to see the comparison. So this has kind of been disappearing from the literature, just like beaks are disappearing from the literature also, because they just realize it's not a reason to call birds dinosaurs. Ancient birds, we have two fossils of ancient birds. I have them here. Had bony tails, long bony tails, and modern birds have very short tails. So this was another reason that the particular groups of scientists decided to call birds dinosaurs. I would say, once again, we don't use the length of a tail to classify species, right? So in the primate realm, we have no tail, like us humans in this room, to monkeys with very long tails, and so the length of a tail has never been a determining factor in classification. When I was a kid, I had a Manx cat. It had no tail at all, but it was still a cat, and nobody thought about reclassifying it because it didn't have a tail. And so tail length really is not a factor we use for classifying animals either. So this is the poster child for evolution. You probably may have seen pictures of it or the artist diagrams. It was discovered quite a long time ago in a quarry in Germany, and it kind of really changed the thinking of birds because it moved them back into dinosaurs. Before, we thought birds only appeared after the 66 million year ago extinction event, but we see now obviously that they lived at the same time as dinosaurs. It's about the size of a raven. Scientists all agree that it has to be warm-blooded because it's fully feathered, so it has down feathers, flight feathers, tail feathers. It's debated whether it's a transitional fossil, and we'll talk about why the debate's there. So the debate wasn't there. Originally, it was like hailed it as being, we finally found a missing link. We don't use that term anymore, a transitional fossil. And then the debate came in because in 1994 in China, we found a bird that lived at the same time as this transitional fossil that looks pretty much like a crow. Has a very large brain, a very large, strong beak like a crow. At first, they were hoping that these were going to be just plant eaters, but we've actually found these fossils are just amazing that they got preserved, found small fishes inside of this the stomach of this bird along with plant material. So it's an omnivore, just like a crow. Has the claw on the wing like the ancient birds had and some of the modern birds had. The only thing that's different from a crow is one is the claw, and the other one is it has these two long tail feathers. These two long tail feathers are interesting. They tell us a lot about this bird. That means this bird was active in courtship. These long tails you see in pheasants and in peacocks, and they're primarily used in courtship display. Has modern feet, just like a modern bird, so it wouldn't be surprised if this bird, or bird very similar to this bird, is the one that made those footprints that we saw 210 million years ago. And so this really put in the ancient winged bird into a question of whether it's really a transitional fossil or not. So the people that are in the band movement, they would agree with what I have here, is that when we classify animals, we look at the distinctive feature. And so over here, we either have a dinosaur with feathers, but if that's the case, then a platypus is really a duck with hair, right? But we don't do that. Why? Because hair and feathers are the determining factor in classifying animals. We put the platypus, you know, in the mammal category because having hair and giving milks are the distinctive features of that animal. Whereas over here, obviously saying this is a bird with a claw on its wing is a more likely scenario than saying that it's a dinosaur. And so the debate rages on. You'll hear a lot of people that claim these birds are dinosaurs say that everybody agrees. And then, of course, the people that don't agree are like, no, wait a second, you know. You can't say that because we've disagreed for a long period of time. From a biblical perspective, one of the things that I would say is, yeah, we have time. We'll go back and look and see how we're doing. I got time here. So birds have got feathers. They have a high metabolism, warm-blooded, large brain, and vocalization. We see that reptiles and dinosaurs are reptiles. Nobody argues about that. They have scales, low metabolism, cold-blooded, small brain, the body size, poor vocalization, and poor hearing. So the difference between there. And then the wonderful thing, obviously, is we have the comparison. You can look at yourself. I'm going to be, after class, I'll be passing around Squeaky, and you can, Myrtle, and you can pet him. And then Mark Durham in the back has brought both a one-year-old tortoise and a 40-year-old tortoise that you can see in the back table in the back after class. So you'll be able to compare the two yourself and see whether this is really a dinosaur. So we've talked about this extinction event 66 million years ago, an asteroid hit in the Yucatan Peninsula, wiped out 75% of all life. And at that time period, dinosaurs went extinct, and also these toothed birds went extinct. So we talked about this a little bit already. So we have two birds, both of them have claws on their wings. And so the debate is whether these had a common ancestor. Or if you haven't heard this term, it's coming up more and more all the time. There's a wiki page on this, and I've been adding a species to it. It started out very short and gone very long. Whether these two animals had convergent evolution that drove them to that, or from a biblical perspective, we really look at nature. We see that a creative designer that mix and matches adaptations as needed. Echolocation appears independently in a lot of species. Wings appear independently in a lot of species. So Darwin evolution is the model that we see for designed for creating new species. And what is always brought up is natural selection and mutation. So I'm going to take a quick look at those, and then we'll be done. The fossil record, when I was in high school and college, that my teachers were honest and said that the fossil record's missing all these transitional species, and said, guaranteed that if you just give us another 10, 20, 30 years to dig up more fossils, and we'll see that the fossil record looks like a tree. What we know now is the fossil record doesn't look like a tree. Species appear, they remain unchanged for a long period of time, and they disappear. The Cambrian explosion is one that we just can't explain, where we have all body types appear at the same time. I picked out two living fossils that I love shortly after the Cambrian explosion, the horseshoe crab and the nautilus, that have not changed. 99% of all species that have lived on Earth have gone extinct. Darwin looked at finches to come up with his idea of evolution, and if he had studied these finches longer, he would have seen that when the beak size got larger on some finches because of the food source, that the beak size didn't stay the same. As soon as the food goes back to normal size, the beak would go back to normal size. And we see this in all species, that you can push a species to change it, but it always wants to go back to the norm. So natural selection works, but it has limits. We have actually have done real-time experiments in natural selection by doing unnatural selection. So for thousands of years, we've bred dogs to be little teacup poodles, and we bred them to be Great Danes, and as soon as you take away a wolf from its normal state, its lifespan goes down and it becomes very sick. So using this test, a whale should only live like a couple of years because it's so huge. You can't take a wolf and change it into a whale. These are all the diseases that you'll see when you move dogs away from where they are. They become very weak and very sick. Dogs have great diversity in their DNA, so we can change them. Chimpanzees has the lowest genetic diversity. There's absolutely no chance in changing a chimpanzee at all from what it is. We've also done this with horses, especially draft horses, large horses. Once we breed them, their life expectancy goes down. The number of health problems just drastically increase. So natural selection can change beak sizes, color, size, temperament, but it has extreme limitations. We've talked about this. Earth has gone through lots of extinction events, and after that extinction event, you'll immediately see a whole new ecosystem come into existence. Occasionally, if you want to know what a dinosaur skin looks like, we have about four or five fossilized dinosaur skins. Yeah, pretty amazing. So this is the major extinction event that wiped out the Jurassic dinosaurs, and they were quickly replaced with the Jurassic dinosaurs. Time for questions.
When I was up there doing announcements, I forgot to say thank you to everybody that brought food. And there's a particular dish over there that I really love. It's the lentil salad, whoever made that. If I had a birthright, I would consider selling it for that lentil salad. It's really terrific. Dave, it's great to hear you talk about something that you're personally really excited about. I have a question for you. I have two questions.
Now, you know the rule. You can only ask one, and then you have to start over again. So
no.
Go ahead.
I'm the guy that enforces that rule, so I get to I get to do what I want.
Okay, go ahead. He has the gold, makes the rule. Go ahead.
What are you being so excited about birds? Obviously, you've thought about a lot about it over your life. What do you think birds, in particular, say about our Creator?
Yeah, well, very creative, obviously, to have these birds that fill absolutely every niche, including Antarctica, right? You know, I mean, humans don't want to spend, you know, all winter down in Antarctica. It's so miserable. The penguins down there are incredible. They also teach us about teamwork. It's so cold that a single penguin cannot survive in Antarctica, so they have to have teamwork, and they actually take turns rotating on the outside where it's very cold to the inside where it's warm. Their ability to pick up emotions is just incredible. You know, we as humans should all study body language. I'm a scout leader, and one of the best classes I took was a class on body language and how much our body language communicates. And as a Christian, every Christian should study about body language and see if their body language, what message it's saying, because there's so much nonverbal communication. And it's just amazing how these birds can pick up on the subtlest body languages. Again, Google like parrots. And their response, they found out a lot of time, is not what you say, but it's the body language that you project. And so we as Christians need to be projecting a body language of love and acceptance.
My second question is, all of us in this room, probably because we live or work or hang out in the San Gabriel Valley, we're all familiar with those wild parrots that fly all over the place very ungracefully and make a lot of noise. Do you know any, they're really beautiful and they're fun to watch. Do you know anything about what the species is, or there's a lot of stories, but do you know where they came from?
It's an Amazon green parrot. It's pretty much established. There was a pet store in Monrovia that caught fire and the owner let them go and they've multiplied. There usually was just one flock, and the reason that you see them, there's now multiple flocks flying around. And an article my wife read just recently and pointed out to me is they're actually going to start planning to trap them and take them back to Amazon. If you're not aware, the Amazon forest is disappearing at a high rate. Hugh has written and talked about, obviously, that the alarming thing, that rather than shutting down cars and power plants, the really danger to our planet is the growth of the Sahara Desert, the growth of the Gobi Desert, and now the shrinking of the Amazon forest. And so the habitat that those green Amazon parrots were in is pretty much gone. And so the population of green Amazon parrots in the Amazons has almost gone to zero. So they actually plan on trying to trap some of those and put them into other parts of the Amazon jungle that are protected or not being logged. Yeah, quite interesting. There's two flocks of those. We have LA, the flock here, and there's also one on Telegraph Hill. Also had Amazon parrots, so there's actually two sets of places here in California where we have them.
So the way we're going to do this is we'll take a question from the audience live and then one from online. We have a nice feel-good.
Go to the mic.
We have a nice feel-good Christmas question here online. Do pet birds have lice? I always see lice on outside birds. How about pets? Thank you.
Yeah, they can get them also. There's two parasites that can get on birds. There's a parasite that actually eats that white casing that flakes off, and that one doesn't hurt the bird. We actually have that trapped in that amber sample that you saw. The other one are lice that actually feed on the blood, and of course those are dangerous to both birds. So if you have an indoor bird, that's not a problem. If you have an output board, it needs to make sure you have a roof over it so that birds don't sit on top of that and drop any disease into the cage. So it is something to be concerned about.
Hey, Dave.
Hi.
I've always heard that pigeons are the only birds that can suck water up and that the other birds get a mouthful, tilt their head back, and let it run down. Any truth to that?
That was what was taught for years. They've actually have found that there are two other type of birds. I don't have them memorized at the top of the house that also use their beaks as straw. So there's three types of birds that actually use their beaks as straws, correct? A pigeon and dove is the same animal. So this is a dove. This is a rock dove. We call it a pigeon, but it's a rock dove. Yeah.
I have an online question from Val Durham. She says, if the Earth undergoes a magnetic pole reversal, what will happen to the birds that rely on the Earth's magnetic field?
Yeah, fortunately, the magnetic field of the Earth has been moving, and so like old maps are inaccurate. You have to keep them updated. The good news is the pole moving is very slow, and the birds adapt to that slow movement. It's not like the magnetic field's going to shift in just 1 or 2 days. So the magnetic field is moving around in Canada. But it's very slow. Yes.
Hello, my name is Rodney, and I saw a black bird about this high. What kind of bird was that?
Yeah, that is a comrat. They're very interesting. The comrat, it's the only water bird that is not waterproof. And so they can actually dive and swim under the water and catch fish, both in fresh and salt water. And what you'll always see them doing is afterwards is standing with their wings out like this, drying their wings. And so they're a black cormorant. They've also been domesticated and used for fishing. They'll actually, in Asia, they'll tie up, put a ring around the bird's neck so it catches the fish, but it can't get it into its swallow, and they make it regurgitate, and they use them for fishing. So it's a quite interesting bird. So that's a cormorant, black cormorant.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Dave, you answer questions a lot faster than Hugh does. This one's from online from Marge Harmon. She says about 15 to 20 years ago, there were lots of drawings of a small feathered dinosaur. One of the RTB publications even mentioned it. What was the final judgment on that?
Now, that's the fossil that I showed you there, the ancient wing. I use the common name. I didn't use Latin names here just because I assume most people have not studied Latin. Those that studied Latin, I don't mean to offend you. That is the one that I showed. It's been the poster child, as I said, for the missing link or the transitional fossil. And because it had teeth, because it had claws on its wing, and because it had a bony tail, it was called a dinosaur. But of course, once we found later in 1994 in China, found that crow that didn't have teeth and didn't have a tail, then of course that's really thrown into debate. Is that really a transitional fossil? Is it some evolutionary dead end? We have lots of those, right? So it's a big problem in classifying species. I mean, basically, you know, you think that it's, you know, these scientists, that it's very scientific, but in reality, they just together and they look at the fossils and it's just really, does this look like that? Okay, let's put them in the same family. And of course, the problem we have now is we talked about with DNA sampling. Now, we expect that when you sample the DNA of these two species that look alike, you expect them to be related. But of course, that's not matching. The classic one is there's three dolphins. Probably people don't know that. We all know about the bottlenose dolphin here. But in China and in the Amazon, there's freshwater dolphins. And so you would assume that since the animal looks the same, has echolocation, they'd be related. Well, they did DNA sequencing on all three of those dolphins and found out that none of them were related to one another. And so the DNA testing has just taken this evolutionary tree and just thrown it out the window, where you really just can't look at an animal and say, oh, this has teeth, it has claws and wings and a tail, and call it a dinosaur. So the answer is no. If feathers are so unique, if it has feathers, it's a bird. If it doesn't have feathers, it's not a bird. I looked at the three evidences for feathers on dinosaurs, and the evidence is just not there. They claim there's signature evidence, chemical evidence in some of the fossils. I even brought a fossil, I'll have it on the table, you can look at back here, for feathers on a dinosaur. When you have a fossil that's 100,000 years old, the chemical evidence in here is really contaminated, it's really difficult to measure. The next one is they claim that on a dinosaur they found a little nodule where the feathers grow out of. The problem is if that nodule was preserved in the fossil, the feather would be preserved also because the nodules are more fragile than the feather, right? And so that's just totally bogus. And the last one you'll see is you'll see a dinosaur that looks like it has feathers going down its head and its back. In reality, that's a frill just like on iguanas. And so some dinosaurs had that frill on the back that you can see. So there is no evidence for feathers on dinosaurs. It's really, really a stretch.
There's a movie called God of Wonders. It's a Christian movie. It's a pretty good movie. But, you know, it has a young earth creationist type of perspective in it. But there's this biologist in that movie that talks about how smart birds are. And he makes a little joke I like. He says, if somebody calls you a bird brain, it's a compliment because the birds are so smart, really.
At first.
They amaze me with their small brains, how much they can do. And I saw a YouTube video. My question is about crows. This YouTube video, of course, you got to always take things with a grain of salt. But this guy claims that he has a pet crow. And the thing has a personality that is ornery, and he'll actually go into his wallet and steal his driver's license and put it in a drawer, and you know he finds like meat from his refrigerator in his shoe. I was wondering if you have any comment about how personalities of particularly crows could could be ornery like that. You know, we've been kind of taught that birds are given for our, as an asset to us, as a friend to us, you know, to keep us company by God. What's with the crows? Are they satanic or?
No, I can tell you what it is. We have a child who had a very high IQ at a young age, and we found that if we didn't keep him stimulated, then of course he would get mischievous. In my personal opinion, when I see the crows, I see my oldest son, that if you don't keep him occupied and keep his brain going, then it's going to go off into mischievous things. And the crows are so smart that they steal things like that just because they're bored out of their mind. You can go on, the last video I watched videos on crows just yesterday studying for this, and it was so cute, is you've got pictures of crows breaking up cat fights. That's how bored they are. Is these cats will start fighting, and they'll go over there and harass the cats to get them to stop fighting. You can find them getting bottle caps and sliding down roofs because they're just, they're so smart that they can get all the food they need in maybe about 2-3 hours in the morning. So they have the whole rest of the day free. And so if you have a large brain and you're the smartest animal in the world and you have nothing to do and there aren't people leaving puzzles out there for you to solve, then you're going to get into mischief. It's pretty quite simple.
We have a philosophy question for you here, Dave, from Slam RN. She says, I'm a believer that my cat has a theory of mind. That is, she knows what I'm thinking, more or less. Animals are not supposed to have a theory of mind. What is your opinion?
No, we talked about that. So that's the unique thing about birds and mammals, why the Bible calls them this nephesh, gives them a special name. It calls them out as special. Is that ability is once your animal is bonded to you, whether it's a bird or whether it's a cat, they're able to pick up, like you said, your emotions, just the slightest little bit. You know, you may not even know that you're upset, and your animal can pick that up. And so they're able to pick up emotions very, very well. And the Bible, we pick this up in the Bible. The Bible talks about, obviously, and we have that in our liability laws, that if your dog goes out and attacks somebody, you're liable. And that's because pretty much dogs want to please you. And if you have an angry dog, all you have to do is look at the owner. And the owner obviously is the one, the dog is pleasing that owner in that aggression behavior. And so you're liable for your dog. On the flip side, obviously, is I've done a lot of jury service. And when I was bored, I would go into courtrooms. It was interesting. A guy was suing because a cat had destroyed a whole bunch of his neighbor's property. And the judge had to apologize and say, I'm sorry, but because you can't put cats in backyards, you know, and keep them fenced up or whatever, that in California law, nobody really owns a cat. And so this person's not liable for this cat, even if the cat did the damage. And he said, on the flip side, if you accidentally ran the cat over while you were backing out of your car, you wouldn't be liable for the cat's death because nobody really owns a cat. And so, of course, then the judge joked and said, so the moral of the story is you can own a dog, but a cat owns you. Or the other one is you call a dog, it comes. You call a cat, it takes a message, and it may get back to you later. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I got a question regarding homing pigeons or male pigeons. So, like, I know in World War I they used to use them, like, after that phone.
World War II.
I wasn't aware of that.
But oh my gosh, it got so bad that in Germany, it became illegal to own a pigeon. Your pigeons, were, you know, both in Lingen and in Germany, there were so many birds flying back across the channel, taking messages, spy messages back and forth, that Germany and England both then nationalized every bird. So anybody who had a pigeon coop and owned birds was under the authority of the secret police in England and in Germany. And England had so many racing pigeons and were bringing so many messages back that the Nazis actually then organized people that had falcons to go out and hunt the pigeons before they crossed the English Channel and sharpshooters to shoot them. So I talked about that 32 pigeons, you know, got medals of honor. One of them was a female pigeon who was shot through the wing and actually survived and got back, and they were able to stop the bleeding in time. And she was so valuable that once she healed, they had to put her back into service because she always would fly into sight and get there. And then the other one is, we talked about that the birds have personalities just like people, and not every pigeon is a great homer. So some pigeons have poor homing availability, or they're just lazy. And so what the England wound up doing is finding those particular pigeons, and they fabricated the little metal canisters the Nazi used to put messages on them, put fake messages in them, drove planes over, and dropped them over Germany. And they knew these pigeons were so lazy and poor homers that they wouldn't fly back to England. They would just go find coops that were there, and the Nazis never figured out that they were getting bad messages, you know, from the English. So the pigeons were used in World War I and II, are used in all different wars. The Greeks used them. They've just been used in warfare all the way up to World War II. After World War II, that, you know, satellite communication kind of eliminated that.
So my question is, if they're used at the smaller unit level, like divisional battalion levels, is the main use from the front to the headquarters, or was it back and forth?
Yeah, well, you would do both. So in the spot, the one I just talked about, the spine, they would let the pigeon go, you know, in they would bring the pigeon and parachute it in for the French resistance, be able to put messages to it, let it go, and it would go back to its home. They also had birds that were so specialized that they developed mobile labs. So you would have a truck, and the truck itself would be the homer. And the pigeons were so smart, and these trucks, the truck could move, you know, 5 miles away, and the pigeon would get up and high up and circle and find the truck and come back. So they were both used to go across the channel, and then once after D-Day, they were used locally.
Yep. Hello, David.
Hi.
Many things I hadn't known about birds. In particular, the lung mechanism that you mentioned. I'd never heard about that the lungs on the bird. I wanted you to define efficiency for me. You know, we're engineers, right? And there's multiple definitions of efficiency, but I also would like to hear a more thorough explanation of the difference. So we humans and most mammals breathe in, breathe out. Are you saying that the bird lung is sort of a straight through kind of device?
So here's the photograph that you gave. So this would be this bird right here. And you can see that there's an inhale sac where the air goes into that sac. There's a valve to make sure that all the air gets into that sac. That sac is squeezed, and then it goes through all these fine tubes that you see here. And the structure of those tubes are very, very highly designed to be able to get all the oxygen out of the air. And then the air goes into the stale air sac, exhale sac, and then they breathe out of that sac. So it'd be kind of like having two bagpipes, you know. You put them together and you breathe into one bagpipe. They have the tube and you breathe out of the other bagpipe. And that gives it pretty much 100% efficiency. Whereas
But the definition of efficiency is...
Oh, to get 100% of the oxygen out of the air.
Thank you. It's not that half the time you're exhaling or half the time you're in. No, that's different.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and that's the reason mouth-to-mouth resuscitation works for us, is because our lungs are only 50% efficient. So if I'm doing mouth-to-mouth and I'm blowing my stale air into somebody else's lungs, there's still 50% oxygen in that, right? Because our lungs are sacs. They take out oxygen when they're expanding, when they're contracting, there's no oxygen there. So mammal lungs and most reptiles' lungs are only operate at about a 50% because it's just millions and millions of little air sacs that fill and compress.
Dave, would you mind if we take the last couple minutes and I had Mark Durham come up and talk about his turtles for a
moment? Yes, I do. I want to just make one other comment, obviously. On these dates here, so from a biblical perspective, I expect that there's a date of 210 million years ago for the first birds to get pushed back, and I predict just from the biblical worldview and the scientific view that date is way too late for the first appearance of birds. Mammals probably will stay the same, but it may get pushed back a little bit. Dinosaurs, I think, is well established here. The first land mammal, that keeps getting pushed back and back all the time. And so my prediction is obviously that we'll see land mammals arrive very soon also. And that completes my presentation, and I'm going to turn over to Mark to talk about reptiles. If you want it on the back table also, back there, I'll have the ostrich egg and my fish fossil. I worked at JPL for 3 years in the Viking mission, so I have Viking photos that you can pick up and look up there also. And Mark, take it away.
Thanks again to Dave. When I first met Mark a long time ago, we went into his garage and he pulled this out of a file drawer.
Well, now these are the things Dave was talking about that some scientists believe evolved into birds. This is a female Florida gopher tortoise. It doesn't swim in water, so that's why it's called a tortoise. It's female, you can tell because it's flat on the bottom. I don't like to lift her up too much if she gets uncomfortable. And hopefully she won't cut loose on me. But they do have one similarity to birds. They have a cloaca. That's the rear end opening. It's a common for feces, urine, and mating and laying eggs. So it all comes through one opening in the back. And so she's about 40 years old, maybe 50. Got her in Florida while it was still legal. Got her off the road, I think it was. I remember brought her home on the plane. They didn't care then. And so she lays eggs every year, but they're generally sterile because she's mating with my male desert tortoise, which is about twice her size. And she doesn't have... Well, anyway, the last 2 years, they did produce some fertile offspring. And... the baby, Valerie's going to hold up one of the one-year-old babies. Well, that's a year old. This is the mother. And that's a hybrid, desert tortoise and Florida gopher tortoise. And the male is so tired. I was going to bring him in, but he's hibernating. So, you know, I didn't want to bother him too much. She's not friendly. She doesn't have much personality. The male does. So Dave was talking about neffish animals. Definitely not neffish. And the male kind of is. He's sort of in between. And let's see, anything else? They're darker. The desert tortoise, if you've seen them, they're kind of brown colored. They got green eyes. These have bigger heads. They're black, and their eyes are black. So that's just some of the differences, but... yeah, some people would say these are cousins of these evolved into birds. Not likely. Turtles have been around a long time, almost as long as the mammal-like reptiles 300 million years ago.
There are prehistoric ones, too.
Yes, there are many prehistoric examples. Okay, that's it.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. Feel free to come up and take a look at the tortoises. And Merry Christmas to everybody. Let's say a prayer. Heavenly Father, we're so grateful for the whole animal kingdom. You could have made this world with just us, and we would have thought it was pretty cool. But you made it with these millions of species of living things that reflect your glory and sense of humor, even, and your sense of creativity, and we just thank you, Lord. What an amazing, amazing world you've given us. I pray that we never take it for granted and that we really learn how to protect the animal world, Lord. Thank you for everyone here. Thank you for Dr. Ross. Thank you for this class. Bless you, Lord, that we can do this every Sunday. Please bless us each as we go our way, and thank you, Lord, for that we can celebrate your son's birth. So thank you. In Jesus' name, amen. Merry Christmas, everyone.
please stay and fellowship and enjoy the food and the friendship.
Larger, and he was the one I always brought to shows. But about 3 years ago, he started chewing on people's fingers, so I don't bring him anymore. Right, it's aggressive male, so it took him a while to develop that. But both of these birds, if I go in the backyard, they get all excited because what I get to do with them is they come in and watch TV with me, and they get to fly around the house, and so. They come in and they have the prop on my shoulder and watch TV with me. So if I go in the backyard, it's a shame. I go back there, check the pool and stuff. They all get excited. I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry. I don't have time to bring you in. So they want to be with me so bad that if I go in the backyard, they do that. They're also bonded to me that I have to have one in my side yard, one in my backyard, because if they saw each other, they would kill each other. They'd be trying to get to the other one because they're so jealous. If she sees me with the other bird, I've made the mistake a couple times of walking outside with the other bird in my hand, and oh, but she'll be mad at me for 3-4 days. She's like, "How dare you have another bird in your hand?" And she's a temperamental female, and she gets all upset, more upset than the male. The male, when she's the other one, he's so bonded, but he doesn't really care. But she gets jealous. Talk about that personality again, right? So she's the jealous one, where it's like, "This is my owner. I'm pleasing him. Don't do that." They talk about the personalities too. If I have big, large aviary, and as I'm bringing them in the house, they've slipped out of my hands a few times, right? Because they wiggle around. I'm not holding them tight enough. The boy is so bonded to me. He flies over and hangs on the screen window because he's so anxious to get in the house and be with us. She, on the other hand, if she gets loose, she'll go up, circle around the house about 4 times so she knows where her food and her water and her cage is. She'll disappear for exactly 24 hours, and 24 hours later, she'll be back trying to get in her cage. Because, of course, there's no food and water laying around the neighborhood.
Oh, they can't really see the TV. Can she really see
the TV? She has excellent vision. Excellent vision. She's the one that designed, obviously, where she has just a 10% blind spot. And normally, you'll always see these pigeons, you'll always see them moving their heads around. The head's never still. And that's because they want to know what that blind spot. They want to know for cats. You know, they're at the bottom of the food chain. So hawks, eagles. So she always is looking around. Yes.
Say this is a dove, not a pigeon?
This is a rock dove, and we call them pigeons, but that's not their scientific name. There is no scientific name for pigeons. That's just what we call them. So this is a rock dove is the scientific name.
What about the pedigree pigeons, white, burgundy, are they?
Those are all doves also, yeah. The people keep these as homing doves because, again, we use them for show, we use them for racing, they use them at weddings, right? Let the white dove go, and it will go back home. So she's just a type of dove that we call a pigeon. She just eats bird seeds. Her millet, red millet's her favorite. She likes white millet also, cracked corn, so she's strictly a seed eater. I raised this. So I got her. She was a little teeny, about this big. And this is Myrtle. So my daughter found her in Monrovia. So it's named after Myrtle Avenue. And because she was little, she was not weaned. She could not eat beetroot. She needed bird milk. But instead of bird milk, you feed them baby formula, just like you can feed babies breast milk or formula. Yay. So we fed her. We had to feed her every 15 minutes. So I would stay up. I would stay up and do the 2:30 feeding, and my daughter would get up, you know, and do the 3 o'clock in the morning feeding. And it took about it took no no it took she could sleep through the night after about a month. So about a month we did that, and she could. No, you know, it's just like normal babies. You start 15, and then after a couple days, you're at 20. A couple later, you're a half hour. So you're just like a baby. You keep making it longer and longer, yeah.
How long will she live?
In the wild, she would only live 3 to 7 years. In captivity, she'll live 20 years. Oh. Yeah.
So because she loves you.
Yes.
She won't go to the bathroom on you, right?
Nah, she will. That's why I have tissues. It doesn't stain. I carry tissues in my backyard, back pocket does, but it doesn't stain. She will go. She will go to the bathroom, yeah. Yeah, you can see the beautiful. She's 13. She's quite old. You can see her beautiful wings. No, she'll do anything I tell her to. She can see. Yeah, she knows I'm not going to hurt her. She loves to be rubbed on the back of her head.
But a stranger's touching, she may get sick.
No, she's not a wild animal. She's a pet, you know.
Yes,
just like a dog.
She may have something, she may get sick.
Yeah. The only thing that gets transferred back and forth, of course, is the avian flu. So if you have a flu, hopefully you stayed home anyways. You're not going to give her the flu. She's not going to give you the flu.
So could she get a person's flu?
She could get, yes. That is a big problem. So they're so, that's what you talk about. They're not reptiles. Reptiles can't get flu, but these are so closely related to more humans than mammals, right? She has our ears. She has our eyes. She has our heart. She's more related to mammals than she is reptiles, and so they do share the flu, unfortunately. Yep. Four-chambered heart, yes. That's very large for her size. Her heart's larger than that. So they have very high blood pressure, and their arteries are actually not soft. They're actually hard tubes because their blood pressure is so high.
Wow.
Yeah.
All of us
are designed for flying, exactly. The lungs, the heart, the arteries, everything is designed, the bones, everything's designed to be lightweight and very high metabolism rate. She's the race car of the animal world, right? The Formula One race car, yeah.
You mentioned the dove, like in the Bible mentioned the dove went and, you know, landed on an olive branch in the water.
Yep.
I'd never heard that.
Then she took, I'm sure she took a bath, and then she got the branch and came back, because that's normal behavior. Right.
But I never thought about it being on the water, because I'm like, how did tree live underwater? Some probably could, but not.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, as long as I'm here, if I had a cage and I left the room and she couldn't see me, she'd be upset. She'd be squiggling around and stuff. But the mere fact that I'm holding her now, she's safe because she can hear my voice. She knows me. She's very calm, obviously.
Wanted to get a bird. I've never had a pet in my life, but I've been thinking about it. What is a good starting bird?
doves are good because they're quiet, obviously. If you get a parrot or parakeet, things like that, they live long and they're very noisy. And if you can't tolerate the noise, I personally can't tolerate, you know, an animal. Right, these ones. They make just this cute little cooing sound. So a little mourning dove or ring-tailed dove are very beautiful. And then, as we said, if you get one, it will bond to you. If you get two, then you just got two birds, you know. That's the other one. Then you have to decide if you're going to have it outdoors or indoors. So she has a large aviary outdoors, so I can walk in there and clean it and be with it with the door closed with her and stuff. And the only time I bring her in is if it's cold and windy. So if it's cold, it doesn't matter. She's wearing a down jacket, right? You know, if it's windy, it doesn't matter because she has her own jacket. If it's cold and windy, obviously the cold can get under the feathers and get to her skin. So the only time I bring my birds in, if it's cold and windy, I bring them out, and that's because of their age. At 13 years old, she's a senior citizen. So in the wild, it wouldn't be a problem, you know. They'll have the personality. She's actually smart, and if it gets cold or windy, she'll actually go into her little box in her aviary. The boy is such a macho person. He has a box, and he never goes in it. He's like Snoopy, you know? It's like, reminds me of Snoopy. I should call him Snoopy. He'll be cold, and he'll be out there shivering or whatever and stuff. I'm like, you got a box right there with the nesting material. Nope, will not go into it. I had a German Shepherd like that, built this beautiful doghouse, would not go in that doghouse unless I went. If I went in the doghouse, the dog would come in there, but he would not go in the doghouse.
Do you trim the cloth?
I do when I show it off to children. I let it sit on children's hands, and so I'll clip the claws before I show them off. So I take them to school. I take her and him to schools and to scouts and show them off. None of my birds, like I said, all my pigeons have lived, 20 years old. They haven't had a problem. Yeah, yeah.
Brought in a picture of picture of our parrot to show you.
Oh, look at that. Oh, well, that looks just like those Amazon green parrots. Yes, yes, yes.
It came out of the flock, yep. Out of the palm tree across the street.
Yeah, yeah.
70 feet straight down.
Yeah. I had one I nursed back to health, and I gave it to my niece, and she had it for a good 20 years or so.
They're long-lived birds.
Yeah, very long-lived birds,
it's
yeah.
It's a healthy flock.
Yeah.
They're a lot of fun.
Yeah, they're a lot
very
of fun.
Very social.
Do they talk at all or just squawk?
Oh, no, it talks and whistles. It's quite a repertoire.
Very
which
good.
Which is unusual for them because they're not great talkers.
Yeah, well, once they get bonded to you, they do. That's the key. So
yeah.
In the wild, they won't. But once they're bonded to you, they will. So that means